Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to welcome you to the last meeting that we're going to have on the Signal Report. Tonight we've got a panel, and I'll tell you what the panel is going to do in a minute. I'd like to introduce them first. We've got at this end Rob McCandless, then we've got Richard Lloyd, and then Dave Mossop, Garth Graham, and lastly Flo Wyatt. We had hoped, or we had extended an invitation to the manager of the Yukon Chamber of Mines to come tonight, but we don't know if he's going to come. An invitation was extended. An invitation was also extended to an NCPC engineer, but he's unfortunately stuck in Mayo. And an invitation was also passed indirectly to the manager of NCPC, and he may be here also, but again, apparently he's being delayed somewhere on the way. So unfortunately we don't have very much representation that we hope to have from industry and mining. I think perhaps we'll start off asking each panel member to give their interpretation of the Sigma Report, of its importance and its implications. And maybe we could start with Rob.
Okay. I gave a seminar on Monday night, and mostly what I was concerned with is NCPC's estimates, or Sigma Resource Consultants' estimates of what sort of power we're going to need for the next, from say 5 years from now to 10 to 15 years from now. And when I did this, I had a graph drawn on the blackboard to show how much power we've been using, our increased use of power since 1960. And I discussed what contributed to this increase in power, and it's mainly mining, that is Whitehorse Copper and Anvil, and also the growth in population here and the growth in the amount of electricity that we use. It seems to be increasing each year, the amount we use per capita, so to speak. So in that way I explained why I thought the power needs had gone up, and then from there I went over and went through Sigma Resource Consultants' estimate of the power that they thought that we would need. And they had something like two overall cases, case one being sort of like a standard growth, and case two including a smelter. And I discussed their various cases. I felt that they were predicting too much, really. They were assuming that the boom that we've had here in the Yukon since, say, about 1967 onwards was going to continue. And I think that was somewhat short-sighted, because in the Yukon for the last 75, maybe 80 years, we've had sort of a boom or bust economy. And they just simply assumed that this would continue. And by sort of guesstimating our power needs in this way, they are ready to say that we need another dam by 1980 to provide this extra power. And I feel that we don't need a dam, because we've got enough power at the turn of the century if we don't have any more mines. And if we have maybe one or two more mines, we might need a dam or alternate power supply, let's say, about 10 years from now, not five, as they're saying. They said that there's other factors besides mining. It might be, say, electric heat. And the figuring that I did, using statistics from Yukon Electric, Statistics Canada, and everything I could get, was that electric heat is still not a very important factor in the Yukon for forecasting electrical demand. And I didn't see it changing, because the electrical rates are going to go up, and they're always going to be pretty much the same as the cost for oil. The other thing that Sigma talked about was a possible smelter or pulp mill, and I feel that it's a highly political decision, and it's going to be made, in effect, in Ottawa by some kind of a giveaway between the federal cabinet and any industry that wants to locate up here. And we don't have much to do with it, and I don't think that it's going to come about, really. These resource giveaways, they're starting to become unfashionable, I think. And then I talked about power available. what we have now, what is coming from AJAC and from additions to the White Horse plant. And it's on the basis of this capacity that I feel that we don't need any power for a long time to come. It isn't so much that I'm opposed to mines, it's just that I don't think that we should subsidize power for the mines. And the whole Sigma report is written around the idea that what we did for Anvil, we will continue to do for any new mines up here. And I think that that's a bad assumption. I don't think that that will happen. So, in summary, I'd just like to say that Sigma is assuming that things will go on as they have in the past. And I think that it's time that we just put the brakes on and just live comfortably with what we have from now on. And they left that alternative out altogether. They didn't discuss it.
Thanks, Arturo. Maybe we can run quickly through the panel and then come back and have people from the audience ask questions. So maybe you can keep your questions for a little bit later. Okay, Richard.
That's the wrong place. I picked up basically from where Rob left off when I left on Monday night. And to me, the basic question remains, how much power consumption do we need to be looking at in the future? NCPC predicts, through the Sigma report, a tremendous increase in this consumption. And as Rob feels, I feel that's sort of a ridiculous assumption. The trends have actually leveled off quite substantially anywhere else from that, and even lowered and dropped slightly some forms of energy consumption. And the demand for energy is quite an elastic thing. I believe if we had an infinite amount of it, we'd probably use it. So whatever Sigma says that we could use in the future, if it's there, I don't imagine it's going to be wasted. although I just read Henry Wilkinson's rip-off book about power and about Eddie Sunlight's plan to electrify the Alaska Highway and other such schemes to get rid of excess watts and amps floating around the Yukon. I thought that was tremendous. But I don't think it's going to be necessary. We'll find a way to use it. But the question is, do we need it in the first place? And that's been an assumption. Rob says getting unpopular, that increased, you know, ever increasing consumption is ever increasing better way of life. For the report itself, I'm not really technically competent to question the discussions they have of impact, etc. Although I know the speakers in these series of seminars that have seriously question it. Going by what they've put in it on the technical effects of the dams, the environmental effects, etc., etc. A lot of it's fairly superficial, and you can pick up, well, as a matter of fact, I have picked up several other environmental impact studies of just about anything from extending the White Pass Railroad to a highway or anything you can think of, and it's all the same. So it's largely, you know, a collection of already existing government facts and textbook knowledge, and it's fine. And I can't really quarrel with it. The quarrel I do have is the way that the whole thing has been presented to the public. I went over that. We were told a few months ago we had the NCPC public meetings, the Sigma public meetings. Sort of led to believe we were in on some kind of a decision-making feedback thing, but you look at the report and it had in essence been written prior to those meetings and supplemented a few pages thrown in about the meetings. So in that respect we led down the garden path. The other thing is the fact that it's not a report, sort of hit on that, that's concerned with one particular scheme or project, something you can focus on. It's goes beyond that. It's a list of all the possible available sites in the Yukon. And there's enormous, an enormous number. And so, again, my concern was that we if we were concerned about the environment, that we don't focus in on one particular site as being more or less damaging than any other. The question really becomes the question of how much do we need to use, because if we don't question it in that respect, there will be a dam. We couldn't, if we just question individual sites, alternatives are available. There's only marginal differences in terms of the economy, economics, between quite a number of the sites. The environmental effects that they outlined, you know, to me are a fairly high price to pay for the power. And that's a personal bias, but I feel that the evaluation as it was done, you know, of cost, benefits, etc., they are very subjective, and my own subjective opinions don't seem to be reflected very well in the report, and I think that my concern about the value of the environment is shared by a lot of people. So far, what I haven't had a chance to read the technical appendixes that came out after the first part of the report, but so far they hadn't done any calculations of the value of the environment, putting a cost value on social or environmental impact and adding that into the cost of the sites, or indeed the cost of the power when they come to compare hydroelectric with various thermoelectric alternatives. So that to me again showed the slant that they were taking from a purely engineering and economic point of view, and could have been done from quite the other way around, at least my feeling. They could have shopped around for an environmentally undamaging selection of sites, and that could have been their first criteria for emission, and then look for the cheapest, but their first criteria for drawing up a short list of sites was purely economic. And I would say purely economic in the narrowest sense of that word, of the cost of the concrete to flood the river, versus what you get out of it. Beyond that, the other criticism I have is, or concern I have about it, is that we're not just talking about the power site, we're talking about a whole way of life, and I think that's where we have to sort of focus our thoughts or discussions about the whole thing. You know, I don't think that the report dealt with that adequately, and nor do I think that it's really the sort of the vehicle to deal with that question. I think that question is strictly a political question, you know, in a broad sense of the word, that this is a question that affects how we're all going to live, and we should all, you know, we all have to could be given some means to express that, and that boils down to a political question. And that's where I see it at. I don't see the NCPC report or any similar report done by whatever experts possible as answering that at all. I think we need all the facts that are available, and that these reports can be valuable in terms of collecting that data and putting it to us, but this still leaves the one basic question for the people of the Yukon to answer, and that's whether we want this lifestyle that will be possible if we go for this route, or whether we want a completely different one.
Thank you very much, Richard. Dave Mossop is with the Game Branch in the Wildlands.
I think perhaps it has been adequately pointed out. I don't know how many of you were here to hear Manfred's presentation to the seminar, but I think it's been adequately pointed out that the wildlife section of the Sigma report is both inaccurate and incomplete, and completely inadequate really for forming land use decisions of the enormity of a hydro reservoir. I'd like to go on from that, leaving that where it lies, and view the report from the view of the from the view of the profession of wildlife management. And I think there's some points worth making. Manfred mentioned that the biological profession is becoming increasingly suspicious of work done by consulting companies, and I think we should discuss that point. You see, there's a very real difficulty faced by these people who take on these chores, and I think a lot of us don't really understand what they're up against. And in many ways, the wildlife section of this report embodies really in one work most of the problems that the biological profession is having with these companies. I'm not going to do this really in defense of the report by any stretch of the imagination, but simply to point out the problems that the profession is having and will continue to have, because this isn't going to go away. This is going to be here for a long time, and the fellow who wrote it has his name on it, and that's not going to go away either. And I wrote out five, I think, points just in reading through the wildlife section, which came to my mind. And the first one is that in the very first thing that one must do when one engages in any scientific endeavor is to find out, to search out what is known already about a subject in your particular field. This is a very time-consuming effort. And in the rushed activity of a consulting operation, it's often difficult to do properly. And the writer of the SGMA report, as Manfred has adequately pointed out, has done himself incalculable disservice in this regard. He just simply wasn't aware of what was available to him when he started out to write this report. And I think that's been adequately hashed over in the last week. The second point is that in any good scientific work, one of the worst cardinal sins is called overinterpretation of the data. In other words, saying things that you do not have the data to support. And the problem that consulting companies have with this kind of ideal situation is that they are paid to come up with answers, and that simply is not the way science works. There's no way that you can pay somebody to do good science. You can pay them for information, but you cannot pay them to make the final conclusion. And therefore they're forced to make decisions on inadequate data, decisions that will please the people who hired them. And this simply is not the role that a scientist is to play. This is the role that the political machinery is designed to play. For instance, the report begins with this statement, which is a real bombshell. There is very little reliable information on the use of wildlife resources, period. The absence of such basic inventory data will present a serious impediment in conducting adequate environmental impact studies. Now, we've already pointed out that that is not entirely true. There was all kinds of information available, but that doesn't matter. What does matter is what he said. In plain words, he said, I don't know anything about the Yukon wildlife, and thus I shouldn't really say anything about it. And then following that statement, he wrote a 35-page report on the subject, which he just said he doesn't really know anything about. Now, if that's not over-interpreting data, I don't know what it is. The third point is another cardinal sin in scientific writing, which is making unsupported statements which are credited to somebody else without indicating who that somebody else is. The writer of this report made scores of such reports, some of which, many of which, sounded a little suspicious, like they started, and I quote, on the basis of an educated guess, for instance, and then quote, specific number. And we're never told, of course, who did the guessing. The only conclusion that the profession can make when they read a statement like that is that the information was made up. We can recognize some of the information as coming from publications, for instance, outside of the Yukon Territory. And even this is worth knowing, because conclusions drawn from information outside of the territory often doesn't apply here. Now the problem that the paid consultant is up against, again, is that they really feel they must justify their existence, and thus they don't like to, I don't know if that's the right word, disclose their sources. And you see, the problem is that when scientific knowledge becomes treated as an item of trade, it ceases to become science. That just isn't the way it works. The fourth point that came to my mind, and really the first three are, I guess, predictable and maybe slightly trivial, in view of what we've already heard from Manfred. The fourth point is one that I think really gives some sadness to us, and anybody who is responsible for resource management in Yukon, and that is that every biologist has an unavoidable duty in any work he does to detail where gaps in the knowledge exist and to design the kinds of research which are necessary to tell us that information. Any science that does, that goes forward, has this obligation. And this, as I say, is perhaps one of the areas that gave us the most sadness when we read the report, because the consultant was completely derelict in this matter. And Manfred already has talked about some of the studies that we think are necessary, what sorts of studies are necessary to tell us how many moose there are in the Pelly Valley, etc. It seems to me that a one-day study flyover of these areas would tell you very little else but an inkling of the kinds of studies that are necessary in an area. Instead, that when one reads the report, the idea one gets is that everything is under control, that the consultant's conclusions are all there, and the wildlife considerations are adequately taken care of. And you can see, again, the problem that the consultant's up against, protecting himself from looking like he doesn't know anything, which is really the position he should be in, and he shouldn't be afraid to say that he doesn't know anything, and this is the kind of information we need. And really the most serious problem that was found in the report by myself again, and looking at it again from the view of the profession, is a fault that has been leveled. I've heard it leveled at other contracted biology before, and I've never really witnessed it myself firsthand, and that is facts tend to get a little distorted in favor of the employer's point of view. And I really am not passing over this lightly, because I think this is a very serious thing indeed. In this sense, it was almost impossible not to draw the conclusion when reading the report, for instance, that the deliberate attempt was made to belittle the importance of the wildlife resource in the Yukon Territory, and to belittle the importance of the wildlife resource to the Yukon people. And I will go into this a little more deeply. Well, we heard such things as, because it's further north, and the further north, a statement was made, the further north you go in the Yukon Territory, the less important the wildlife populations become, because the area, the country is less able to support them. Which is interesting, because one of our healthiest, really, moose populations in Yukon is north of the Arctic Circle. Now, really, this ploy, I think, has to be the greatest misunderstanding of the people who live in Yukon that I really have ever heard. Yukoners engage in perhaps the one that the report dealt with, so it's the one that I will deal with also. But he dismissed this hunting as recreational hunting. Yukoners don't appreciate wildlife necessarily, they just like a lot of recreation. And the term seems to mean something, and is given the implication that something is completely dispensable. And I think it would have been very valuable for him to have considered a game branch release that's almost a year old now, which calculated the meat value, protein value, of only four of our big game species at over $1 million a year to Yukoners, to resident Yukoners. And I believe the calculation was made on the basis of meat costing $1 a pound, which I think is rather an underestimate. I think I'm right in saying that there are very, very few Yukoners who consider their hunting as just recreation. The report goes to great length to belittle the success, and I don't know why they did this, of hunters on the Yukon. And here he really got into trouble, because he states that his criterion is, quote, the ratio of hunters to game taken, unquote, which when you calculate from the figures which he gives in a table right there, it turns out that Yukoners have a 66% success. This is incidentally true, but using his figures. This, he says, is low compared to the 36% success in BC. He then presents a table which is supposed to clinch this argument. And this table is really an example of bad biology, if there ever was one, because he compares the total game harvest from the province of British Columbia to the total game harvest of Yukon Territory, and says, look, they kill a lot more animals in BC, so their wildlife resource must be a lot more valuable to them. And not taking into account, of course, the size of British Columbia and the fact that 11,000 hunters, that's 1968 figures, I don't even have but it's probably over 15,000 now, I don't know, people in British Columbia kill the animals in his table, as opposed to about 2,000 in Yukon. And if you do the calculation using those figures, it turns out that hunter success in BC is only 8% as compared to 66% in Yukon shows. The trappers also would be very interested in learning from this report that the game which they take on their general hunting license is taken for recreational reasons. People in Yukon Territory would also be very interested to learn that game meat, this is a quote, is eaten primarily by natives and whites in the remote regions of the territory. I suggest that one of the remote regions must be Whitehorse. And no attempt, of course, is made to ascertain the non-consumptive value to Yukoners. And I really can't comment on that. Perhaps I think we should keep in mind, as in closing, then, a comparison that's very graphic in my mind between the pipeline research that we've heard so much about in the northern Yukon, the hundreds really of thousands of dollars that have been spent on wildlife concerns over a pipeline which is to be buried in the tundra, a relatively benign thing when you think about it, compared to this work which involves really the complete annihilation of a large section of countryside as far as wildlife is concerned. And the comparison is very graphic in my mind. Thank you.
Thank you very much, David. That's very interesting to you. Okay, Josh Graham, would you like to make some comments?
After Dave Mossop's analysis of what's wrong with people who make statements, I hesitate to say anything. I myself cannot claim any particular technical knowledge with respect to the Sigma report or with the question of hydroelectric development either. And what I would like to comment on is some of my understanding of the public process of influencing decision making and the role that environmental organizations can play in that, and perhaps suggest some directions that might be taken by people here in taking the information that you're being presented with through this series of seminars and utilizing it in a variety of ways. My background in this is that although I am not currently a member of the Yukon Conservation Society, I was for a period of time a member of the board of directors. And I think the most specific way that I can talk about public decision making and this kind of resource development issue is to say some words about why I'm not a member of the Yukon Conservation Society, and not, although it's an area in which I'm still interested, my experiences in the Yukon Conservation Society. Several years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, when I was active in the organization, it was quite apparent that an organization of this nature operating in Whitehorse, in the Yukon, with a population of essentially what it has now, had some very large difficulties facing it in actually accomplishing anything in the area of making comments on resource allocation, land use, or development. The Yukon population then was small, is still small now. At that point in time, there really was no visible way of drawing out of the Crown corporations that operate in the Yukon, the government agencies that operate in the Yukon, and the major companies that operate in the Yukon, technical information that would allow anyone who wanted to state alternatives to development to allow them to present their case in any kind of a rational or reasonable manner. It simply wasn't possible to do it. And so people who were concerned and interested in operating in the milieu of an environmental organization or a conservation society really couldn't do anything more than stand up and say, look, we care about this. Of course, that carried no weight with consultants, that carried no weight with the government in terms of decision making, that carried no weight in terms of corporations who are interested in resource development. I see that from this there's an implied role for environmental organizations, and that is to advocate development alternatives that do something about dealing with the problem of social costs and social benefits, and to present alternatives which are something more than purely economic. And in this, Richard Lloyd has mentioned this as well, I think that most cost-benefit analysis gets couched in terms of total dollars of output, jobs, productivity, increased market, the benefits of increased population, which may or may not be direct and real social benefits. And I know that there is a prevalent opinion in decision makers in the Yukon that you cannot measure social benefits. And I assure you that is not so. There are means of measuring social benefits. They happen to be rather imprecise, but they are developing rather rapidly. And it is possible to at least make an attempt. So there we have a role for a conservation society to state alternatives, and to state those alternatives in terms of social benefits. And 2 or 3 or 4 years ago, we had an enormous amount of difficulty in digging up the information that was required in order to state those alternatives. Another problem that we had was that the people who were concerned and were interested had rather traditional models of citizen participation and traditional models and understanding of the political process. And it was very difficult for them to see ways of utilizing whatever information they might have been able to get a hold of. And secondly, and perhaps more importantly, it was very easy for them to be co-opted by a traditional political process. I can assure you that no one has a greater interest in environmental organizations in the Yukon, in their viability and in their being able to state alternatives, than the Department of Indian Affairs and Northern Development. The Department of Indian Affairs and Northern Development has been actively attempting to foster environmental organizations in the Yukon for as long as I have been aware that there was a need to state these alternatives. I think it's fairly easy to see why they would be interested in a general sense. If you are a planner in Ottawa and you're familiar with a variety of sophisticated planning necessities, such as social benefits, and social benefits, for example, of something like Kluane Park, not to the people who live in the Yukon, but to the people who live in Canada, and then you come to the Yukon and you make that statement, and then the entire population rises up and says, here's another goddamn civil servant from Ottawa, and you get sent packing, and the Globe and Mail writes a story saying, Yukoners don't want a park, or something, you know, to give an example of what happens to federal people at the planning level and Department of Indian Affairs. It's fairly obvious that it would be very useful for them to be able to anticipate a certain sympathetic hearing for some of their interests in the Canadian North. That points out, at the point in time I was involved in Yukon Conservation Society, some degree of co-option by a fairly traditional approach to political processes. There was then a very real interest on the part of the federal government. There still is, and there still is a danger of a local organization being co-opted for national planning purposes. Or willy-nilly, it's an area which is perhaps subtle, which has to be kept in mind when you act. Now, the situation, as I see it, seems to have changed, and nothing could be more clearly indicative of that to me than the meeting which Sigma held in Whitehorse, which had such a phenomenal audience and such a fascinating audience. I think I've never seen so many divergent opinions in the Yukon all in one place. There were people in the room who are utterly convinced that it is in the best interest of the Yukon to develop enormous hydro dams with enormous development of secondary industry attendant with them, and that this would be the best of all possible lifestyles for us. And perhaps it would, I don't know. There were people in the room who were convinced that perhaps we should shrink the population a little bit, get rid of a bunch of people, slow things down quite a bit, and go down to an energy level that consisted mostly of hewing of wood and drawing of water. And they may be right as well. But they were all there, and they were, for the first time that I ever seen, clearly visible. In other words, there are many communities of interest now in the Yukon, whereas several years ago, it wasn't that clear that there were many communities of interest. So that's one thing that's changed the climate. The second thing that's rather interesting is that I think that this series of seminars has clearly indicated that a group of people who are interested in engaging in resource development debate can get the technical expertise they need out of those very agencies out of which they couldn't draw before. Now, I'm not sure why this is so, but Mr. Mossop is here tonight, Manfred Hoff has been here, there have been technical people here at this seminar. It now seems possible to do what wasn't possible before. And the third thing that I am observing is that there are people in the community, in the Yukon community in general, and particularly in Whitehorse, who are quite familiar with patterns of citizen involvement, who are quite familiar with community organization, who are quite familiar with non-traditional methods of influencing the political process or of involving in public debate, and they're quite prepared to participate in doing this. So I think the climate for the Yukon people, or that segment of the Yukon community which would like to consider resource development alternatives and have something attached to them other than funds, I think the climate for them actually to accomplish something is relatively better than it was when I was actively involved in it. So if that can be taken as a note of optimism, that's something. The problem, as I see it from this point on, is that the public decision-making process is enormously obscure. For example, as Rob McCann was mentioned, if a smelter is to develop in the Yukon, that's a decision that isn't going to be made here. And that's true, it's not. It is going to be a deal between someone and someone else. And no one knows where that deal is going to take place or at what point in time, or in fact, whether it already has or not. But that's the way that decision is going to be made. So the only way that a group such as the Yukon Conservation Society can influence that kind of a decision-making process is by giving evidence that there is a large body of specific public opinion that is contrary to the objectives of that kind of decision, and that is going to be a problem to deal with. And that's, you know, in other words, the very exercise of presenting these seminars and the fact that there is public support and the fact that the press is reporting them in a certain manner does in a way give evidence that there is a segment of the Yukon population who are interested in the environment in something more than the sense of the environment of their own homes in the middle of the winter. As was stated earlier in the week, another thing for which I am aware about the decision-making process is that in a large measure in Canada, organized elite groups, elite's a sort of a sociological expression, organized elite groups can influence the decision-making process. In other words, there is a body of people in a country such as Canada. Canada is an enormously small country. In terms of people, in terms of geography, it's an incredible place. In terms of people, it is an enormously small country. And at the senior levels of decision making in Canada, the number of people involved in that are relatively few. So organized elite groups in Canada can influence the decision making process because they're in effect co-workers. They're part of the same game. So one thing that I can suggest most strongly for a local group to pursue relationships with national organizations with similar interests. It's time and effort very well spent to participate with national environmental organizations because they can and do sit down with federal decision makers, they can and do sit down with industry, and they can and do change the climate of decision making, which as I said is obscure and not particularly structured. So two things. I think it's very important to continue the public visibility of resource alternatives that are other than simply economic. And secondly, I would strongly suggest connections with national organizations for support.
Thank you very much. Actually, that was good. You've answered really a later question.
Good. I don't have to ask you yet.
Give the basics and the others. Flo, perhaps you'd like to comment.
Martin, I think you'll have to ask the question again. You wanted reaction to this report.
Yes,
no.
Yes.
I will have some things to say later about the climate forest.
Yeah, I think you've got to jump in a little bit there.
But reaction to the report, but you wanted something definitely on the report. I think since I'm not a scientist and I know nothing at all about hydro, and I'm not a member of the Conservation Society, I should qualify myself before this hearing. probably as a Yukoner and a consumer and a housewife. I have no other qualifications for appearing here except that I've been attending your meeting. I think the only fair way to take a look at this report from a completely, I'll say it, unbiased point of view, which I think I entered the seminar holding, which is to look at their terms of reference and what they were hired to do and the objectives of this program, planning program, which are reported in this report, were to describe the first phase of a program to establish the power resources of the Yukon Territory and alternative schemes for development of such resources to meet a range of possible power demands to the year 1990. Now, they were not apparently asked to determine whether or not the Yukon wanted another hydro development, which I think probably is step one. We are now at step three before having taken the first two steps. That's my own personal reaction. We have now got a large report describing the first phases of a planning program for a hydro development. No, they start by describing the existing generating plants and transmission facilities. Then they give us an inventory of all the potentially attractive, quote, hydropower sites based on surveys and studies which have been done before and since. Then there's an analysis of the growth of the demand for power with projections to the demand to 1990, which some of our speakers have differed on. A comparison of the more promising power developments on the basis of cost and the environmental and social effects. It wasn't just on cost that they were to determine this. Although, as you pointed out, they gave cost a priority in their tables. Preparation of a preliminary system plan and selection of the leading schemes. Then a systematic presentation of the criteria and methodology for evaluation of future power schemes. And then preparation of a progress report during the course of the planning study as a basis of an information brochure for distribution in the Yukon, which we all saw at the public meeting. Now, as I understand it, that's phase one. Phase two follows next year or later this year when, on the assumption that a specific site has been selected as the least objectionable or most desirable, depending on which side of the debate you are sitting. Then they do phase two study in detail of all these things again, stressing the fields which they did not complete in this one. Now, I may be optimistic about that, but this is what I get from reading the report. And I don't have to be a scientist to see gaps in that information. I myself have a number of questions here that I scribbled down as I went through the report very quickly. We need other studies, we need more facts, and we need more information about a number of things. After phase two, into which I assume there is still some public input, you go on to the planning of the installation and its actual construction by 1980. I think that's a rough timetable. So if you do not blame them for leaving out the first two steps, which they were not hired to do, do Yukoners want a new hydro development? They weren't asked that question. They were asked to report on a program to establish hydro resources and their priorities. So, reading the report quickly and comparing all their graphs and charts about most impact on what and least impact on what and what's most desirable and what isn't, I have to come to one deduction, which is not part of my criticism of this report and probably is the next stage in your panel. But before we get to that, Sigma points out that we now have a supply of 80 megawatts. We will have when AJAC comes online. My reading tells me that half of the amount of power now being generated by Northern Canada Power Commission is diesel power. We know that fossil fuels are going to be the most costly means of providing that power. It would seem logical to me that you would want to substitute a cheaper source of energy than diesel fuel, which in this country is hydro. At present, mining uses 60% of the total load. Mm-hmm. Anvil itself uses a third of the total. We have been told during these seminars that it is a very good possibility that there will not be increased mining demand because present mining properties will phase out, and B, new ones may not phase in. Now, this is certainly acceptable to me. One factor that I think we have to admit is fair is that Yukoners use far more than the Canadian average, according to Canadian statistics, not this report, CanStat or whatever they call it in Ottawa now. Our average annual use is 10,000 kilowatts, and the average Canadian use is 7,800. So whether that affects your ultimate demand picture or not, I don't know. I'm interested in a further in-depth study of coal supplies for geothermal resources. I think we all got the message from Dr. Craig that there has not been a complete study done with that purpose in mind. I think perhaps we're at the point where we need a geological survey, a request from YTG to GSC for this study. Apparently it has not been asked for recently. I think the timing is right now. We might have a realistic alternative to hydro at a later date in another area, rather than putting in another hydro dam. Another thing they are basing cost figures throughout this report on 1973 dollars, which really bothers me, in 1975 for a construction period of 1978, 9, and 80. But at the same time, they are basing fuel oil prices at last year's level as well, and we are now almost up to the international level, and we'll be paying twice as much for our fuel oil as they have been estimating in this report. There are actually 100 sites, as our speakers have told us during this seminar. 16 were considered for this study on 10 different rivers in the Yukon. One quote on the environmental bit, which I think is fair. The environmental assessment in this initial phase one, of the planning program is an overview to begin to identify the issues and to establish the limitations of the available information. They did not try to provide specific, final, overall details of that study. The next step is to collect sufficient baseline information to enable selection to be made of the next power development, so that an environmental impact assessment can be made and field investigations and design can proceed. So, you know, environmental studies do get equal billing there. I have to act as the devil's advocate in this debate because there don't seem to be many people on this side. So phase one is the planning program with public meetings and, quote, high level of interest in this approach was indicated at the public meeting, and they got the message. What happens in phase two? I think that this seminar's value to that phase will be that whoever does the second study, whether it's this outfit or someone else, they are definitely going to be paying attention to what has been said during this seminar, and they are definitely going to be taking into consideration the objections that have already been raised before we hear any more from phase two. As one of the other speakers has said, the costs in this study do not include the possible loss of values in fisheries, forestry, wildlife, recreation, or tourism. But I would certainly demand and expect that those figures would be available in phase two, because then they are getting down to the crunch cost figures and plans for construction. There was just one other thing before. I've been reading the pipeline hearings all this week, incidentally, and I came across some codes which also apply to this kind of a public hearing, I think. On economic development in the North generally, if I may introduce this now, Martin. Yeah. There is no longer a grand assumption that development is good in itself and is in the public interest as long as it results in some sort of measurable surplus or gain, profits, tax revenue, more output at lower prices for consumers. This is a quotation from Jean Chrétien speaking to a seminar on science and the North 2 years ago. We now ask, what is the purpose of this development? In whose interest? What interest should have the priority? What group is likely to be hurt? Who shares the decision making? By what mechanism? What time perspective is involved in this development? By what criteria is efficiency to be measured? These are the things they're asking about the pipeline, and I think one of our speakers has already said we're asking here. And Chrétien's actual quote on this: what matters most is the people. How can the conditions of life be improved for the people of the North? And what we are finding to be equally important, how can this be done in ways that they themselves want, rather than ways that we have predetermined